Blog Talk Radio. And how you can support MPH. So bear with us today. They're going to be sort of busy and packed. And outside of that, let's continue to work together as we're filling out missing pages of history. So let me just give you something to think about as it relates to freedom. When we talk about freedom, many times people have died over this concept and still fighting walls over this concept. I think it's important for us to try to get some kind of working, functioning definition, understanding of what is this concept of freedom. Because so many people have lost their lives and continue to lose their lives trying to achieve this thing that we call freedom. We give you two examples. One is from Martin Luther King, as he stated to him when you talk about freedom. He stated, there comes a time when people get tired of being plunged into the abyss of exploitation and nagging injustice. That was his response to this question of freedom. And that was another conceptualized definition of freedom that came from Jackie Robinson, where he stated, life is not a spectator sport. If you're going to spend your whole life in the grandstand just watching what goes on, in my opinion, you're wasting your life. Let me just read that one again. He said, life is not a spectator sport. If you're going to spend your whole life in the grandstand just watching what goes on, in my opinion, you're wasting your life. What do you think about those two concepts today of freedom? How do they fit into your life? So we just want to give you a little something to think about. And right now, we're going to make our transition to Sister Susan for MPH. He's going to share with you some MPH Black Men of Facts. We first and foremost would like to welcome our Sister Susan to MPH Radio. Welcome, Susan.
Good evening. Hi. I'll be giving the Black Men of Facts for April the 3rd through April the 10th. And the first one is on the 3rd with Dr. Carter G. Wilson, African historian, died in Washington, D.C. in 1950. And on the 4th of April, while organizing workers, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee in 1968. On the day of April the 6th, Pan-Africanist Congress of Avania founded in 1959. And also on that date, young Black Panther organizer Bobby Hutton killed fighting police in Oakland, California in 1968. On the 7th, Mozambican Women Day in honor of the anniversary of Josina Michelle's death in 1971. On the 8th, Hank Aaron broke Babe Ruth's U.S. baseball home run record in 1974. And I've just given you some many black facts for the month of April.
Susie, for her excellent presentation on her Black Men of Facts. And right now, we're going to make our transition to a clipping that's going to set the backdrop for today's topic and theme, which is Africa Today and Tomorrow. This is a documentary which you can find on YouTube. And it's titled, How and Why the West Want Africa to Stay Poor. And we want you to listen very carefully to this particular clipping. And when we come back, we're going to open up a discussion around this question of Africa today and tomorrow. This is MPH Radio, and let's go and listen to this clipping right now. Again, the title is How and Why the West Want Africa to Stay Poor.
What this presentation is fundamentally designed to say is this. Africa, historically, sub-Saharan Africa, has been fundamental to the global prosperity of the advanced countries. Okay? And Africa had a role to play. It has a role as a raw material producer. We will not allow sub-Saharan Africa to escape that. Okay, we do everything to keep sub-Saharan Africa where it is, also impoverished. It's absolutely vital for the prosperity of everyone else. So let's get clear about that. Okay, and this means all the economic structures, all the global institutions, and the economics we teach everyone is all designed to keep Africa exactly where it is. And whether it is Europe or US or now China, it's always the same. We need Africa to be impoverished because we need those raw materials and we need them dirt cheap. Okay, so that's the message. It doesn't mean to say that there's nothing Africans can do. Of course there is. Okay, but this is the opposition that they're fighting. This is what it's about. Because if Africa does do something different, I assure you living standards of all those in Europe and North America and Asia is going to fall. Okay? And that is a big price to pay. I assure you that the West is not going to allow that without a big fight. Okay, so this is what it's fundamentally about. What I want to show you is how these structures are operating. It's just 20 minutes, so we can't do very much, but just to give you a little bit of an idea. And why I keep the ideology part there is because we are part of the producers of ideology. At universities and academic institutions, we are complicit in this whole enterprise. Okay, so the job of many Western academics is to convince Africans they have to keep doing what they're doing. Okay? And to show them, it's your fault that you're poor. It's not our fault. It's your fault that you're poor. You know? So this is what we do in academic institutions. And I want to show that as well. To start, this is what it's basically about, so you know what it's about. But I want to just show you the extent to which Africa is specializing in the production of raw materials and basic agricultural goods. We know the basic forces that have caused this underdevelopment. We know it's colonization. I will not discuss that very much because my colleague speaker is going to go into some aspects of this. But I do want to discuss the global economic structures, the global financial institutions, and economic ideology, briefly, to give you a flavor of those. Let me start with this. You can't really see it so easily, but if those of you who are interested, you want the PowerPoint, I'm sure we can make it available to you. But the thing that you really need to see, the top line, okay? And the extent of dependency is captured by this statistic at the top, okay? And you compare it with all other income groups, and what you see is essentially in that one statistic how dependent sub-Saharan Africa is on raw material production. Okay, this is the very heart of what makes sub-Saharan Africa beat. Okay, here, just to have a look at one very important additional statistic, with all this export coming from sub-Saharan Africa, how much does sub-Saharan Africa account for in terms of global trade value? We know there's vast resources coming from there, but look at the bottom line in terms of global trade value. Look at that. 0.5% 1975, 0.95% going down to 0.1, meaning that with all these vast resources being produced, how much are they getting for it? Nothing. Nothing. This is a very significant piece of data. Then I just want to show you what has happened to sub-Saharan Africa, because what we know, and from all studies, No country ever develops without manufacturing. Okay, producing raw materials will not take you anywhere. Producing basic agricultural goods will not take you anywhere. And let's have a look at how much manufacturing activity takes place in sub-Saharan Africa. We can look over the last 15, 20 years. And we see manufacturing has actually declined as a percentage of the total. This is percentages of total production in sub-Saharan Africa. How much of it is accounted for by manufacturing? So this figure here is 17% of the total. Most of the rest, when we talk of industry, it includes manufacturing, but the bulk of it is mining. Okay? Raw material extraction. This is the bulk of it. And here we see actually raw material extraction has stayed the same. What has caused industry to fall is the fall in manufacturing production. This is deliberate because we will never, as Western economists, as Western policymakers, we cannot afford to allow Africa to industrialize and start producing manufactures. Okay, so we will do everything to stop that. And I'm going to show you how we actually block that. It's obvious in certain ways, but it's less obvious in other ways. Now, we have actually seen periods of rapid growth in sub-Saharan Africa, misleading people, saying, oh, you know, we're now doing much better. And this has happened recently. Recently, I've had students come and tell me, we've done much better now. And you can see growth rates rose quite sharply in recent times. Now are starting to go again down. But if you look historically, the same thing happened earlier. Why? Because in these two periods, we had East Asian rapid industrialization processes. So in the earlier period, we had Japan and Korea and Taiwan. Okay, rapid growth, sucking in raw materials from Africa, driving up the prices, and then sub-Saharan African countries grew. Exporting raw materials, they grew. But after those countries finished industrialization, then sub-Saharan African growth rate again fell. Okay, but along comes China. Next wave. Okay, again, sub-Saharan African growth rises, but now China is going down. As many of you now know from the press, China is going down. But sub-Saharan Africa is going down even faster. And we're going to go back to where we were again with very low prices of raw materials, very low growth rates, and again, the sorts of poverty that we saw once before. Because, bottom line, sub-Saharan Africa is condemned to this role, just the supplier of raw materials, not a manufacturer. Very recent data showing emerging markets that produce raw materials against emerging markets that produce manufactures. And you can see now with the weakness in the global economy, it's the emerging markets, that's the red line, it's those countries that are suffering the most, the emerging markets producing raw materials. They're suffering the most. And here, it translates into their currencies being butchered. Okay? The currencies are collapsing of these countries. And many of them are sub-Saharan African countries. Some of them are Latin American countries, okay, who also rode that same wave. They thought that raw material production was going to save them. But now they're facing terrible problems. And I'm sorry to say, it's just going to get worse in the next 2 years. It's not going to get any better. And this is what it does in terms of gross domestic product. It's the blue line you should look at. It's the blue line compared with the red line. And what we know is that blue line is really going to go down sharply in the next 2 years. Okay, so relative to the rest of the world, Sub-Saharan Africa is going to suffer. Again, why? Because it's condemned to this raw material production. This is basically why. How is it condemned to that? Well, the first and most important is the economic structures. After colonization ended, we needed new structures to keep these countries where they were. Okay? And the first of those is aid. Okay? We give them aid. Aid for what? Actually, we give them aid to keep repressive regimes in power. That's all. Okay, we're not giving them aid for much more except a little bit of infrastructure to make sure those raw materials get to the ports and aren't gotten out of the ground. But for the most part, we give repressive regimes money and power and guns to keep that system going. This is what it's fundamentally about. All the hypocrisy about transparency and democracy and bullshit like that, it's all bullshit. You know? And at least the Chinese don't enter into that bullshit. They say, we don't care about the whole political environment, we just give the money. Okay? And it's for raw material extraction. Period. Okay? Number two, and this was a very important one, still is, debt. I was telling some of my students today, was it today or yesterday, about Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Do you remember? Have any of you heard of this one? Confessions of an Economic Hitman. It's a book written by John Perkins, who used to work for a very nebulous, opaque bank. No one had ever heard of this bank. But it was formed in the 1950s by the IMF, the CIA, and the American State Department. And it had only one job, to lend money to developing countries that were raw material producers in order to indebt them. Once you are in my debt, I control you. Okay? And this bank had 4,000 employees. But no one ever heard of this bank, you see. But it would go to country after country offering loans. And if the president did not accept the loan, they were killed. And he gives two examples of presidents who were killed when they did not accept the loan. You see, the lending is also very important to trap the country. It's very important. It's part of that process. I teach in Suriname. And Suriname in recent times had a huge foreign exchange reserve. So big they didn't need to borrow money. And then one of my students, who was very high up in government, he said, you know, the IMF is trying to convince us to borrow money from foreigners. Why? I thought, duh, you know, sorry about this, but, you know, this is the game. And in the end, Suriname did borrow this money because the IMF said, if foreigners lend to you, then everyone will think Suriname is such a strong economy that foreigners are interested in lending to you. You understand? Before Lula came to power, you know, the previous president in Brazil, Cardoso, his predecessor, took a gigantic international loan. No necessity for taking the loan. Why? Because once I catch you with the debt strings, I hold you forever. You are my prisoner. Okay, so debt has been this huge spider's web which has trapped sub-Saharan Africa and keeps them held there. Aid, debt. We have a third structure which is again not known by many people, but it's something that was put in place and continues to this very day. With no one discussing it, no one says anything about it, it is monopoly buying structures. This is for all raw materials and basic agricultural goods produced by developing countries There are only four or five Western multinationals that buy all those goods. And they collude between them. So if you take any major product, these Western multinationals, they collude between them. Even if we go down to banana production, we had a PhD done here at the ISS, and the person showed that the four or five major multinationals, they collude, and in order to make sure their control is total, what they do is they force all the producers to produce the same uniform banana. You know, the crap you buy in the West and has no taste at all? You go to any developing country, you know how a banana tastes, don't you? There's so many of them, lots of varieties, but we only market one or two types, so we have control, you see. If you don't produce at the price I want you to produce, I go to the next country. You see, we get control. So these buyers, they impose that control, and they keep pushing the prices down and down and down. Okay, this is the game. No one says anything about it. There are no commissions of inquiry to say, this is illegal what you're doing. The WTO has nothing to say about this. But sorry to say, you know, if banana prices rose 10 times, especially for people like me who love bananas, okay, I protest. I like my living standards. Okay, it's the same with all the other raw materials, you see. We're all benefiting. We're complicit. We're actually complicit in this because we will protest and shout out if the situation ever changed. Okay, now we come to those international institutions. And I must tell you this, from the outset, don't think of them as wicked. IMF, World Bank, WTO. We always think evil creatures. Horrible. It's not. It's just economics. It's economic warfare. The rich declare war on the poor. It happens everywhere. It happens in a country. The rich control the government. Of course they do. You really believe you have democracy? Come on. You know, I mean, grow up. This is not about people living in democratic systems. What we have is the rich control. The rich set up these institutions explicitly to control the poor countries. And they don't give them much room for maneuver. Which incidentally, when the IMF starts talking of poverty alleviation, you should also understand that there's another game they're also starting to play, which I'm going to come back to later. But what do these institutions do? What does the IMF do? What is structural adjustment about? It's about making sure countries keep producing what we want them to produce. We make sure they have recurrent balance of payments problems. You notice these countries never get out of balance of payments problems. You notice that? Whereas countries that never took IMF support are always out of balance of payments problems. But the countries that are continuously getting advice and support by the IMF, they're always in balance of payments problems. Why? Because that's the way we keep our stranglehold on them. And that's what we have done. We have done, the IMF and the World Bank. And they've also done something very, very important. And that is they have destroyed the self-sufficiency of these countries. Colonization started it. Okay? One of the most important things is we destroy food self-sufficiency. Okay? And the World Bank continued it. They forced most countries to eliminate all food subsidies and food support. Okay? Because once you don't produce your own food, I increase my control over you. How do we know this? Well, very funny thing happened some years ago. Not so funny, actually. It involved starvation of a large number of people in Malawi. Okay? Many of you could remember this because it was really tragic. But the Malawian finance minister, who was under terrible threat at the time, suddenly broke ranks and he said, well, you know why we had this famine? because one of the conditions of the loan given by the World Bank was we destroyed all our grain surplus stocks. Why? Because remember, we want you dependent. 1970s, the US Senate, the US Congress said, we will not allow Latin America to produce their own food. We will start a strategy involving the IMF and the World Bank to destroy food self-sufficiency of Latin America. Then they will indeed be our true backyard. And that's exactly what they have done. Look at all the Latin American countries. Look at them. They used to be food self-sufficient, but they are no longer food self-sufficient. Now here comes the kicker. This is the beautiful part of it. I congratulate them. You know I admire them because they do it so well. Okay? I know it sounds really perverse, but we have now in the WTO something called the Agreement on Agriculture. Okay? You know what that Agreement on Agriculture states? It says, if you don't have any subsidies, you're not allowed to put these subsidies on food. But if you have subsidies and income support for food production, you can keep them. Who has all the subsidies and income support? US, Europe. The largest budgets in the world for supporting their farmers are Europe and US. But the World Bank and IMF have destroyed all those subsidies. You see, all those subsidies have been destroyed. And now we're telling these countries, you don't have subsidies, tough luck. You know, you see, we're keeping them dependent. We're keeping them on a string. I have 5 minutes, so I have to be choosy about what I say next. We have lots of examples in the WTO to really stop Africa industrializing. This is the crucial thing. We cannot allow them to produce manufacturers. It's not difficult. Trust me, it's not difficult. We need nationalist governments. We need them committed to industrialization, and it won't take them a decade to move out from where they are. This is the fundamental point. It's not difficult. But this next round of the WTO is designed to block that. If we had time, I would go through all the different things that they're trying to put into place to block anyone else getting on top of the ladder. You've read this book of Hajun Chang, Kicking Away the Ladder. You see, when we become rich, we make sure the others can't climb up the ladder and join us. Okay? And this is what this next Doha round is about. It's to make sure, especially sub-Saharan African countries, do not escape. Since I have about 3 minutes left, I'm going to go to this economic ideology thing, because this is important for academics. You see, we teach, in many cases, garbage. And it doesn't hurt anyone, a lot of this garbage. You know, it's a blah, 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 blah. And we don't know what we have learned, but anyway, we were there at the university and you got a certificate and you go away and you feel you've learned something. But sometimes we teach very destructive things. And no more important than when we're teaching people from developing countries. Okay, and one of those very damaging and destructive things is the doctrine of comparative advantage. It's a lie from beginning to end. It's utter crap. It has been decimated many times, but we keep it in every curriculum. Why? Because it tells sub-Saharan African countries that their destiny is to produce raw materials, you see. And if you produce raw materials, you get rich just like we are in the West. You see, this is the game we're playing, and just for you to be totally confused, we normally build models with it, mathematical models, so you really have no idea what we're talking about. But it seems all very scientific. Then we have the modern version of this is because it's all a failure, we know it's a failure, we now have a new generation of economists saying, it's only a failure because you're all corrupt in your countries. We call that new institutional economics. You've all probably learnt it all, but you didn't know why they invented it. It was invented to tell you the same thing. You should keep producing raw materials. Now, don't be as corrupt as you were before. Nobody ever told you that aid was designed to actually start the corruption process in the first place. Okay, and we need corruption to make sure you're doing all these things. But now we blame the victim. You're poor because it's your fault, basically. And you're poor, stupid, and corrupt, basically. This is the message that we're giving people. We also have many theoretical justifications, but I'm going to say something controversial to end. And she's happy that I'm ending because she has to discipline me. And that is, there are also what I call more enlightened approaches, but which are also potentially destructive for sub-Saharan African development. And this is where I come back to the IMF and the World Bank. You see, now they're all into poverty alleviation. They want you to concentrate on redistributing income, and it's something nice. You're young people, you're socially conscious, you're aware. You don't like all this injustice. So you gravitate towards what we call pro-poor strategies. But actually, I'm sorry to tell you, that is not what Africa needs. Africa needs aggressive industrialization. When China was a communist country and we had equal distribution, who feared China? Who took them seriously? They weren't even the size of the Netherlands. But today, I can't open an internet site. I can't open a magazine. I can't open a newspaper without China, 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 China. And we know what has built China. It's not socialism or communism. It's capitalism, guys. It's manufacturing, it's production. This is what creates employment. This is what creates a job. So I'm not pro-capitalist, but this is the reality. And unfortunately, we're now going to get caught with the good cop, bad cop. The good cop is now IMF saying, oh, you must concentrate on poverty reduction and income redistribution, as long as we can take you away from industrialization. This is the crucial thing. You know? I leave it at that. And I'm sorry I took so much.
That's right. Welcome back to MPH Radio. You're listening to the voice of MPH Radio, and you just listened to a clipping titled How and Why the West Want Africa to Stay Poor. Our topic today is Africa, today and tomorrow. We are happy to have with us invited organizations and representatives of organizations who have done a lot of work with, around, and in Africa. They are here today to help us fill in one of our missing pages of history as it relates to Africa. We would like to welcome our invited guests. We have with us Brother Kamal Benjamin and Brother Bamboshi Shango from the All African People's Revolutionary Party. And then we also have with us Brother Maurice Kani, who is a representative of the Friends of the Congo. They will be discussing this topic, and we would like to have you to join us by calling in at 818-337-0016 and let us collectively fill in this particularly important missing pages of history. Before I bring my panelists on, I would like to just give you a backdrop why we believe this subject matter is important. And I think it can be understood by listening to this first paragraph on this book, The World of Africa, written by W.E. Du Bois, when he stated in the foreword. In the first paragraph he wrote, since the rise of the sugar empire and the resorting cotton king, there has been consistent effort to rationalize Negro slavery by omitting Africa from world history, so that today it is almost universally assumed that history can be truly written without reference to Negro people. I believe this to be scientifically unsound and also dangerous for logical social conclusions. Therefore, I am seeking in this book to remind the readers in this crisis of civilization of how critical Africa has played in world history, past and present, and how impossible it is to forget this and rightly explain the present plight of mankind. That's a powerful statement. And with that backdrop, we now would like to invite our invited participants and welcome them to Missing Pages of History. Brother Kamal, welcome to MPH Radio.
Yes. How are you doing, my brother Lee? I'm glad you invited us to discuss this topic and the panelists that you have are very knowledgeable about what's going on in the past in Africa and what's happening today. And it's very critical. Since the Berlin Conference, the balkanization of Africa in 1884, it was all designed to separate parts of Africa, French, Spanish, British, German, to exploit those particular areas of Africa. And by design, your topic today is right on the head. It's continuing. All of that was an effort to keep Africa from uniting. You know, we say Africa must unite under scientific socialism. You know, that is our destiny until the day we die. So, you know.
Thank you, Brother Kamal. We now would like to welcome Brother Bamboshi Shango to Missing Pages of History. Welcome, Brother Shango.
My brother, thank you very much for inviting us today. We always appreciated you and your show, and we know that you make the greatest contribution to the intellectual and the organizational development of Africa and African people. So we thank you very much. Your team is right on time, as Brother Kamal just said, because Africa now is faced with a series of issues and problems that has been caused by the conference Kamal just mentioned, the Berlin Conference, but even more, the updated version of colonialism and neocolonialism that has taken place, which includes the U.S. military, which includes food insufficiency, which includes water wars that are coming. And it's good that we begin to talk about them so we know how we can move forward and deal with them. Thank you, my brother.
Thank you, Brother Shango. And next we bring in from Friends of the Congo, Brother Maurice Connie. We would like to welcome you as well to MPH Radio.
Peace, Brother Lee. Thank you for having us be a part of the discussion today. We look at the heart of the African continent. We see a situation where since the trafficking of Africans, we haven't had or experienced African people the type of devastation that we've seen in the heart of the African continent, in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where over the past 125 years or so, we've seen two waves of severe destruction as a result of capitalist, imperialism, colonialist efforts to extract resources from that geographic location in order to advance Europe. 1885 to 1908 saw the destruction of an estimated 10 million Africans as the Western powers extracted ivory and rubber in order to fuel industries in the West and advance capitalism. And most recently, from 1996 to the present, we saw the destruction of an estimated 6 million African lives, half of them children under the age of 5, as Western powers and extract coltan and cobalt and a range of other minerals, and using agents of neocolonialism in the region to advance the plunder of the Congo. Speaking specifically, figures like Paul Kagame of Rwanda, Yoweri Museveni of Uganda, who serve the interests of the imperialist forces at the expense of Africans. So look forward to discussing with you what Congolese are doing and those who are in solidarity with Congolese to confront neocolonialist forces, to tap into the spirit, the ideas, the teachings of great revolutionary leader Patrice Lumumba in order to fuel and continue his drive for a free and liberated Congo and a free and liberated Africa. So look forward to the discussion today.
Thank you as well, Brother Maurice. My first question to all of y'all, I'd like for y'all to just give me your general impression. Since, you know, the boy stated that when we look at world history, many times it doesn't even seem like Africa has been totally omitted. As a result, it has created many, many problems among our people, particularly our youth, in terms of trying to understand what Africa is and what Africa is not. So I'm going to ask each one of y'all, if you had to share your understanding of what Africa is and what Africa is not, what would you say to our youth and our people today? Start with you, Brother Bamboshi.
That's a question that really begs a maybe 1 week long or 1 month long or even a 1 year long response. And I think the question might be a little unfair, but I tell you briefly that it is important for you to understand Africa because, one, it's their home, but even more than that, it is under constant attack and bombardment. And because of that, we as a people, wherever we are in the world, exist in the lowest positions, in the lowest capacities. And we need a united Africa, strong and viable, to lift us out of these conditions. So I would beg our youth to become conscious of this and to not just know, but also put this theory into action by working to help to unite and liberate Africa.
Brother Kamal, your response. What would you say to the question what Africa is and what it is that?
You know, I can, you know, tell from my experience as an African growing up here in these United States, or attempting to grow my history of knowledge from my school days. In what we call Tobacco Road in North Carolina, at Shaw University, no history of Africa, of course. I mean, it was like Africa did not exist at that particular time when I was in school, in the history book. We weren't taught that. And many other universities, middle school, high school, and elementary schools, it was not taught. Like, Africa did not exist. And if it did, it was in discussion, it was negative in terms of what was going on in Africa or what Africa was at that time. Until the civil rights struggle, Africa became unknown. You know, every university wanted to teach black history because they had to struggle and fight for it. You know, today they're trying to turn the clock back on Africa. They don't even want to teach slavery. They don't even want to discuss the history of African struggle in this country. That just shows you what imperialism and capitalism does. And people must understand how vicious it is. And the proponents, you know, the red, the back, what we call redneck line of thinking in this particular country, you know, about what happened during the history of slavery in this country, let alone talk about Africa, and you know, except from the time that they invaded and exploited, bought slaves, and took all the mineral resources from the continent. You know, these are the only things that they want to discuss. IMF, World Bank, you know, what they did to Africa. Not only to Africa, but to other developing countries throughout the world. We must understand that. You know, we had to fight to teach the history of Africa in our school, in this country, you know, let alone what it meant to other students and young people around the world. So this is what our struggle is about today. And it will continue.
And Brother Maurice, give me your take on how would you define what Africa is and what Africa is not? Can you hear me, Brother Maurice? Okay, thank you. If you're having some technical difficulties.
I can hear you, brother. I can hear you, brother.
Okay.
Yes, Africa is the origin of humanity. Modern man, woman first set their foot on the African continent. Africa is the mother of civilization, the arts, the sciences, that we see today is a product of Africa. What Africa is not, brother, is Africa is not poor. That is, it's a continent. It's the richest on the planet. That is, that has been plundered for the past 500 years or so of its, first of its human resources, and then later of its natural resources. Africa is not defeated. The colonialist and imperialist forces would like us to believe that it's a continent that has been defeated, as a beggar land, but to the contrary, we have young people throughout the continent that have taken up the mantle of the past generation of liberation leaders, talking about figures like Lumumba, figures like Nkrumah, figures like Michelle, Samoa Michelle, figures like Blouin, André Blouin, all figures who sought to reclaim what had been lost with the hundreds of years of the trafficking of Africans and the plunder of the resources. So the probably the biggest thing I would share to the children of today is that they are part of a tradition of resistance, a tradition of freedom, and that battle is fully engaged at home and abroad, and we encourage them to be a part of that effort. First, by learning the history of the continent, as Du Bois laid out, discerning the lies as he identified with this, that how many Europeans propel this Hegelian notion of Africa. Hegel said Africa had no history because Africa had no great wars. But the greatest wars fought on this planet were those wars to traffic African bodies from the continent to the West, to serve as labor for the plantations in the Western Hemisphere. So that's what I would share with the young people of today, that they're part of a rich tradition of struggle, rich tradition of resistance, rich tradition of liberation fighters, and that they too have their responsibility this time in order to continue that tradition until we're fully free, liberated, and sovereign on the African continent.
Well done, my brother. Brother Bamboshi, when we talk about Africa today, when we look at Africa today and understand its past history, what would you say would be the major obstacles or contradictions that Africa is dealing with and in order to move forward as a free and sovereign continent?
My brother, thank you for that question. I would say that if you look at Africa today, the major issue, the major problem that is facing Africa is the problem of neocolonialism. And what do we mean by that? By that, we say that under colonialism, which occurred because of the conference Kamau spoke about, the Berlin Conference in the 1890s, Africa was divided into European colonies. And in the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, even the 1980s, and the latest 1990, South Africa became liberated, but struggles took place throughout the continent for independence. And countries became independent left and right. And now we see a re-attempt to colonize Africa, basically under a a process that is known as neocolonialism, where instead of having direct colonial involvement in the continent of Africa, the European and the U.S. is attempting to create those individuals in the different countries in Africa who will lead Africa for and in the interests of the European and U.S. powers. These countries are called neocolonial countries, and they're led by neocolonial agents. To ensure and impose this neocolonialism, the U.S. has created a force called AFRICOM. AFRICOM is the African Military Command, which is basically the United States Army in Africa. I think when you look at these issues and the other issues that are being created by things like climate change, things like the ability to control your own resources, you see that there is a need for a struggle to, of course, unite all of Africa and to ensure that the African population, including the African population in the diaspora, sufficiently participate in the struggle and sufficiently benefits from this struggle. So I think this is probably the point that we are at in history, and our history is also a very long history. So that's what I would say.
Thank you, Brother Van Bosch. And
just let me know.
To Brother Maurice, in terms of dissecting the ongoing struggle and issues that are taking place in the Congo and that region, give our people your analysis of what the current reality of the difficulties that the Congolese and our brothers and sisters in the area is facing. Talk a little bit about that.
Well,
because one of the problems we have in today is we don't have independent sources that can verify what's going on within our communities in Africa throughout. And your organization have an excellent track record of working directly on the ground with the people. So talk a little bit about that with our audience.
Sure. I would concur with Comrade Bamboshi about the macro challenge of neocolonialism, where you have agents of neocolonialism really on several levels, but definitely two levels. One, the instability that we see in the Congo, the ongoing conflict for the past 25 years or so, being led by agents of neocolonialism, proxies of the West. Again, I'll mention their names, Paul Kagame of Rwanda, Yoweri Museveni of Uganda at the forefront. And really, it's not just me or Friends of the Congo saying this. Just a few weeks back ago, the International Court of Justice had addressed a case where the Ugandan government was found guilty of plunder in the Congo and is called to pay $300 million worth of reparations to Congolese. And the same fate would have met Rwanda, but the Rwandan government is not a part of the, is not party to the International Court of Justice. Because both Rwanda and Uganda fought each other inside the Congo, their armies fought each other for control of minerals, not minerals that they would actually process themselves, but minerals that they would extract and ship out to the West to be processed by the West for pennies on the dollar. So you have that challenge of neocolonialism, where the agents of neocolonialism wage war and perpetuate conflict in the Congo. Now, in the Congo itself and its head of state, their heads of state, and just about everyone since Lumumba, is also an agent of neocolonialism. That is to say that their interests are best served by Western powers, and as opposed to the people themselves, and they're usually imposed on the Congolese people, and are sent to power in the country with the backing of the greatest imperialist force on the planet today, the United States. So you have a president that's in place at the behest of the West, and what they do is they serve the interests of the West. That means they invite the World Bank in, they invite the U.S. military in, as Brother Bamboshi laid out in the case of the so-called African Command. And it shouldn't be lost on any of us that the Africa Command is not an African entity. It's a U.S. It's a U.S. command, U.S. forces militarizing Africa. That's really the more appropriate term, because the Africa Command that we're all familiar with is the one that Nkrumah called for the United States of Africa to have its own command to address its own military challenges, not for the United States to develop a so-called African command, which, interestingly and noteworthy, it expanded the greatest under a so-called African, a president, a U.S. president of African ancestry, President Obama. African command was developed by, or the command was developed by George Bush when Obama took it on. He expanded it by some 2,000%. Where now we have African forces throughout the African continent, quote-unquote, fighting terrorism, and even the most casual and objective observer would have to acknowledge that if, in fact, that their aim was to fight terrorism, it's been a tremendous failure, because with the increase of U.S. military presence in the Congo and elsewhere on the African continent, we also see an increase in terrorism. So surely they cannot be there to fight terrorism. So that militarization of the continent, of the Congo and the continent, the imposition of the so-called Bretton Woods institutions, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the other European institutions, Paris Club, London Club, all of them having their way in the Congo and on the continent. So those are the challenges that, the macro challenges that Congo is facing. And then you have the challenges that are a result of hundreds of years of the extraction of Africans from the continent. It was the Congo region where we saw a large percentage of Africans being extracted. If we follow UNESCO data and we look at the Emory University database and the mapping of the extraction of Africans from the continent, 4 out of every 10 Africans came from the Congo region. The carving up of the continent, as Brother Kamal laid out, the so-called Berlin Conference, where Congo was exceptional in the sense that it was not colonized coming out of the Berlin Conference, but rather it was given to King Leopold II as his own private property, is owned by the king, with the proviso that it would serve as an open space of extraction and movement by all European powers, because it was so big, it was so coveted that European powers didn't want to go to war over it, that they called it the Congo Free State. And it wasn't freedom for the Congolese, but freedom of movement for Europeans, freedom of movement of commerce and goods, and European power being free to join the king in plundering the Congo. And then you have the wars that have been imposed on the Congolese people, and dictatorship that has been imposed on the Congolese people in the case of Joseph Desiré Mobutu, for over three decades. It was installed by the United States and maintained. So with all of this, you have a country that is severely underdeveloped. You know, we, as Walter Rodney laid out in his work, how Europe underdeveloped Africa. And with very little infrastructure, less than 10% of the population having access to electricity, over 16 million people on the verge of starvation, even though it's a country that has the agricultural capacity to feed the African continent twice over, 2 billion people, if we follow the food, UN Food and Agriculture Organization's data. So the Congolese youth in particular, the women in rural areas, are trying to come up from out and out from under this, unbrotherly. And they're waging an incredible struggle. We're working with women farmers in the south of the country, youth, climate justice seekers in the northeast of the country, young people in the east of the country who are just coming out from under the eruption of one of the most dangerous volcanoes on the planet. And what you find is that throughout the continent-sized country, basically, it's like a subcontinent, you have a tremendous vibrancy, tremendous work being done, but it's not, that work is not being elevated by the state, not being supported by the state. And our contention is the work that's being done in the Congo, the innovative work that's being done, the struggle that's being waged, if it gets the proper support, then it can, as Fanon shared with us, it can ignite an entire continent. So in spite of all those challenges that are being faced by the Congolese people, what we see is women farmers, youth climate justice seekers, young organizers in urban and rural areas are waging an incredible struggle to create a new Congo within a Pan-African vision and framework as articulated by Lumumba. So we as Friends of the Congo exist to, in part, to highlight that, share that with the rest of the African world so that we can mobilize support in the heart of the African continent, which, if it's controlled by Africans, can reverberate throughout the entire African continent.
Kamal, you are a member of the All African People's Revolutionary Party, GEC, your political party, your massive Pan-African organization. How does the role of Pan-Africanism fit into the scheme of trying to create a united and strong Africa?
Well, let me say, it must exist because we need political education. In Africa, but tonight, we are Brother Kamal,
yes. Is it possible you can maybe get closer to your mic? You sound a little distance and breaking up.
Oh, I'm sorry. Okay. We're talking about 65 years of African liberation. You know, we were in the streets for the last 40 years organizing African liberation. The world to know the importance of Africa. And we organized many work studies, the Caribbean, Africa, and even in Europe, of teaching and struggling to unite Africa. And you can see the importance of our struggle because the enemy has been struggling to overthrow various leaders and assassinate various leaders. Thomas Sankara, we can name the throughout to show how the enemy, neocolonialism, capitalism, imperialism, the clip that you let us hear about the IMF, the World Bank, how they have been used to explore the continent, and its leaders turn leaders together. Matter of fact, the colonizing fields that fought themselves, they fought over Africa. Who would take this part? And over the metal and resources that they were taking from Africa. So Africa is very important to us and to the world. And it's the reason why we should continue the struggle to unite Africa. We must continue to struggle. We had organizers and liberators such as Kwame Nkrumah, Sekou Toure, David Du Bois. I mean, we've gone and on and on about Patrice Lumumba, about the importance of the leaders who were struggling to unite Africa and why they were overthrown or assassinated because of the importance of, say, the Congo, the importance of us uniting Africa, understanding the history of our people. So this is what our struggle is about. And our struggle will continue. When we pass and move on, our youngsters, our children, must carry on the struggle. That's why African Liberation Day, as I said, we celebrate 65 years of African Liberation Day. I mean, it must continue. Just like, you know, the European powers, you know, throw up the country that they want to show you how important the mineral resources are that they extract from the land. It's important to them, and it's important to us to not let them explore it and take it. That is why it's so important that we must unite and continue to struggle.
Brother Bamboshi, you know, we talk about different reactionary forces, whether it comes under the category or the title of imperialism, Zionism, capitalism, racism, you name them. When we talk about these forces, one of the things I think it will become important to try to understand our people's plight and oppression is how oppression is applied to their daily lives. For example, when we talk about the rural banks, when we talk about government's economic policies, when we talk about tools of oppression such as like NAD, or we talk about IMF, how do these variations of tools interact in Africa to ensure that our people continue to stay oppressed? Just talk a little bit about the different form of tools and games that are going on that our people need to be aware of so we can make a conscious effort on knowing not only what to fight as well as how to fight it.
Thank you. My brother, thank you very much for that question. I'd like to respond to it, but of course I'm here at Nappy Roots Books and I'm the only person here, so I would like to know if you could possibly go to the next speaker and then come back to me.
Okay, we'll do that. Brother Maurice, when we talk about the Congo, when we talk about the Congo, when we talk about the Congo, brother. When we talk, Brother Maurice, when we talk about the Congo, and, you know, we know it has a long, long history of human rights violations and killings of millions and millions of people. But for some reason or another, the world still does not know about that history. Talk a little bit more about the history, but also I'd like to get your response of how do you feel about the kind of response to Russia and Ukraine getting, where you're talking about innocent lives and civilians being killed, while you look at the history of the Congo, you have not heard anything, Holly, about the million lives that have been lost, in that area. Your response.
Sure. Thank you, brother. Thank you for the question. Can you repeat the first question again? I got the question about Russia and Ukraine, but I didn't quite get the first question.
I just really would like for you to elaborate a little bit more on the history of the Congo as it relates to this question of human rights, violation of human rights.
Yes, clearly,
you're talking about international human rights and look at the rule of the West, are you not really seriously guilty when you're talking about the Congo and the rest of the world?
Yes, yes. You know, there's this one of African heroes on this side of the Atlantic, George Washington Williams, who was a figure that fought for liberation of Africans here against slavery, and while gone to the Congo in the late 1800s, I think around 1890 or so, and he said what he observed at the time was tantamount to crimes against humanity, right? His life and his work is documented in a book by John Hope Franklin called The Biography of George Washington Williams. And the reason why he said that was because he, like a counterpart of his at the time, William Shepherd, observed the atrocities that were being committed by, under the name of the King of Belgium, King Leopold II, in the Congo. And the chopping off of hands, for example, if a family member did not deliver the quota of rubber that was requested or demanded of them by the colonial or Belgian colonial.
Think we can't hear you, brother Maurice.
Did you lose me? Can you hear me now?
Okay, good. We can hear you now. Yes, we can.
Is that better? Is that better?
Yes, that's better.
So I was saying that the quote-unquote human rights violations that have been taking place in the Congo are legion. You know, you talk about the how the current conflict that's unfolding in Ukraine gets the world attention, and yet the millions of lives lost in the Congo do not get attention. The same level of silence has been imposed on the Congo as it relates to the tremendous loss of life over history. Because today, you talk to anybody about the Holocaust and what Hitler did in Europe, and they automatically can reference it. You know, 6 million. You know, they say 6 million Jewish people lost their lives. But when you talk about King Leopold II and the 10 million people just a few decades before Hitler in Congo and his responsibility for that, there's silence. Like it doesn't exist. Nobody knows. So both historically and contemporarily, we see this silence around the loss of African life, the devaluing of African life. So when today it's blanketed in the media about the suffering that's taking place in the Ukraine, it's a reflection of and the value they place on it compared to African life. And it's even a little more extensive or in-depth than that, because when the empire wages wars and backs wars, it's not the role of the empire's media to expose those wars and to expose the empire the victims of the empire. What they'll talk about is the beauty of the bombs that's being dropped on the black and brown people in Afghanistan and Iraq and in Syria and in Yemen, right? So the corporate media's role is to advance war and advance the interests of the empire. So when the empire is backing wars in the Congo through its proxy forces in Rwanda and Uganda, the corporate media is not going to tell that story. It's predictable what we're seeing today, in that it's in the empire's interests for the corporate media to expose the atrocities and the suffering that come about as a result of war. If you were to leave it to the corporate media alone, you would wind up walk away believing that it's only wars initiated by Russia that causes suffering of civilians, right? The wars and the multiple wars that's been initiated and imposed or led by the empire, there's no suffering of civilians. In fact, the suffering of civilians is characterized by the media as collateral damage, right? Not a mother losing a child, not a child, you know, being the victim of U.S. bombs. And it even goes further than that, brother, because if by chance the wars that have been imposed by the empire is exposed, as was the case by WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, exposing the war crimes of the empire, then those who expose the war crimes of the empire are persecuted and pursued, right? As we see today currently with Julian Assange. He's being pursued by the empire for exposing the war crimes of the empire. And you would think the corporate media would point that out. But no, they're silent. While a fellow member of the media who's doing the job that they were supposed to be doing is being pursued by the empire. So I think the hypocrisy underlying the coverage around Ukraine is so rank, it's so blatant that if you were to write it in a novel, people would say that, you know, this is fantasy, but this is actually reality and what's unfolding. So it is no surprise that the human rights abuses, the casualties that have piled up in the Congo have not pierced the veil of the world consciousness, because what's unfolding in the Congo is a product, in part, of imperial forces, of the dominant empire in the world today, the United States. So it's not going to be exposed, and it's not going to be presented to the world by the corporate media in a way that we see the suffering being exposed today in Ukraine.
Thank you, Brother Reese. Brother Kamau, you know that, like all countries and nations, they cannot function like an ally by themselves in this international arena. We see the issues and problems that Africa is having as a whole. When you look at the relationship between various nations, who would you say are Africa allies and who are their enemies?
Well, you know, as we said earlier, that U.S. imperialism, Europe imperialism has dissected the continent for their own economic and political reasons. They have exploited the continent. They've taken billions of dollars from the continent.
rich scientists on this planet. $1 billion resource that they take on the time, let alone the people that they've used for 400 years. Free labor for 400 years to build the empire. They are continuing the exploitation of the human resource that it took from the time. So we must understand that in order to struggle against it, our people must understand not only on the continent, but here wherever our people are have been scattered throughout the diaspora. They must understand that because wherever they are being exploited. You know, they have to struggle to live, to eat, feed their families. We must understand that. That's, you know, as I keep stating, why political education is so important that we teach it. We must understand and teach ourselves that. And it makes us aware wherever we go. We can discuss it with our brothers and sisters. I remember one experience, and most you can relate to it, going to Bolivia. And we decided to contact the brothers and sisters in Bolivia, even the youngest. And believe it or not, they were aware of their plight and situation. They had Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, on the wall pictures. You know, so our people around the world, most of them understand their plight. But as I said, they're struggling against the enemy to liberate themselves economically and politically, wherever they are. So we all must relate to our brothers and sisters on the continent in this struggle. And it's so important for us and that to keep up the struggle, unite, and organize ourselves. We must be organized. That's, you know, the bottom line. We must organize ourselves. And the enemy is struggling to keep us disorganized. You know, IMF, the World Bank, NED, National Endowment for Democracy, all of these exponents are there for the same purpose. We talk about the Ukraine. They want to bring 100,000 Ukrainians here, but they won't let Haitians come. You know, the Haitians just sent back. So you understand it's race, still racism. But, you know, they don't point it out. We must point it out. They want to justify. It's unjust. They cannot justify that. You know, our people are our resources and our strength. And we must keep them aware of that. This is why it's so important that we must unite and organize ourselves.
Thank you, Brother Kamal. And see if we can connect back with Brother Bamboshi. Brother Bamboshi, are you there?
Yes, brother. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah.
I'm trying to multitask. And what happened is that about 5 years ago, we opened a bookstore in Oklahoma, the only black bookstore in the state. Today, we now have 3 other black bookstores, 2 in Tulsa, and 1 more in Oklahoma City. But I'm not good at multitasking, and so we had a customer, and I couldn't respond to both, so I'm sorry. I would like to deal with the questions that you ask, especially the question of NED, which Kamal just spoke about, because it's interesting to know, and we should know, that when NED was founded, the founding director of NED said in the opening statement that now today we have a organization that can do openly what the CIA used to have to do undercover for years. this is the role of NED. And NED has four components. There's the National Democratic Institute, which is somewhere hooked into the Democratic Party. And there's also the National Republican Institute, which is also hooked into the Republican Party. Both of those are components of NED. And they are the components that usually attempt to facilitate regime change around the world. And the funding of opposition social movements in countries that the U.S. are interested in trying to reverse the revolution that's taken place in those countries. They also have the Chamber of Commerce Control National Monetary Institute inside of NED. But most importantly, I think, is the NED, which is a component of NED that operates under the AFL-CIO, but funded by NED, the International Labor Institute. And as you know, the CIA used to have the International Labor Organization that also did the same thing in the past on the cover. Now, the National Labor Institute of NED has bought out most of the labor movements on the continent of Africa, which put their membership, those organizations' membership, in the position of supporting imperialism and being in opposition to the masses of their people. And probably the best example of that is what when they attempted to influence the land reclamation program in Zimbabwe. Anyway, NED is a very dangerous organization. NED funds regime change throughout the hemisphere and the world. And I think that we ought to look at NED because NED is in control of a number of other organizations that are social movements in countries. And they appear in countries as progressive social movements when in fact they're not, such as this so-called movement inside of Cuba to raise the question of racism in Cuba that is based in Miami, that is basically an anti-Cuban organization, and it's anti the government and the people of Cuba. I think that the issues today of the U.S. wars is that they are so multifaceted that we don't see how these several different components fit together to act as one. NED is one of these components, the National Endowment for Democracy. I think that our panelists, of course, have mentioned and spoke to this, and they are very clear on what NED is. I think that it's necessary for all of us, for the African people in the U.S. and abroad in general to understand, but for all people to become clear on the role of NED. Because as you can see historically, once folks became clear on what the CIA was doing in countries abroad, the opposition to these wars immediately emerged. And you saw people saying, we will not support the Contras in El Salvador. And you saw people saying that we support the mothers of the disappeared in Argentina. You see people rising to defend the revolutionary processes in Nicaragua, in Venezuela, in Cuba, in Brazil, in Ecuador, in places in this hemisphere that they would not have done it had they not begun to realize the role that U.S. wars in those countries were playing, and also the role that the CIA had in them. Now, we said NED is just one component of the new processes of war taking place by the United States. It is an extremely dangerous component. But another component that we must be aware of is sanctions. Sanctions is an act of war, and sanctions kill. Today, you have over 40 countries under sanctions by the U.S., including at least three on the continent of Africa, the oldest being Zimbabwe, but also Ethiopia and Eritrea. And there are more coming. There's a discussion about putting Mali on the sanctions. What sanctions does, it's an economic form of war that cut off resources and utilities to people and create a situation where the masses of the people in the country, and sometimes the governments, but for the most part, the masses of the people in countries that are sanctioned bear the brunt of the sanctions, and sanctions kill. Sanctions kill when you have people who cannot get the necessary medicine because they're sanctioned, cannot get food because it's sanctioned, and all of these necessities for life are open to being sanctioned by a country that is trying to create some kind of regime change in those countries that's on the sanctions. So we must look at and understand them because they're coming to Africa fast. Fast. They're coming. We must be prepared for them.
Thank you, Brother Gilboshi. Coming back to Maurice. Maurice, you know, in terms of working with the youth in Africa, the youth in Congo, and your analysis of looking at Africa in relationship to the leadership role of AU, African Union, what would be your assessment critique of the role and the behavior of the AU as it relates to trying to liberate and unify the continent of Africa and get rid of this oppression that African people face? Because many people see the AU as a neocolonial tool. What is your assessment of that? Or what is the people in Congo? How do they view this role of the AU, particularly just recently when they allow to give a seat to the Zionist state of Israel, where historically African countries have always been in opposition to it? Speak to those issues.
I would concur with what folks say about it being a tool of neocolonialism. And yeah, they did give Israel observer status. Fortunately, there was enough pressure that they recently reversed that decision and took away the observer status from Israel. I think it was at the end of January or early February that they did that. And probably the best example I can give is what our sister Zuma had said, Nkosazana Dlamini Zuma, who was the former chairman of the African Union Commission. And she was, when she took on the position, right, she said she was shocked. I don't know why, but she said she was shocked that I think she gave like up to 96% of the African Union Commission was funded by Europe, by outside of Africa, right? And if you, I'm sorry, did you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yes, we can. So that gives you a sense. You know, our sister Dlamini Zuma, it was clear to her, if it's funded by up to 96%, then, you know, there's a whole, you know, Bantu proverbs that, you know, said that the hand that feeds you is the hand that controls you. And that's the commission overall. The so-called military or security wing of the African Union funded primarily by France. So there is no question that about the nature of the institution, where it's funded primarily by Europe, and then the one African brother, the one African nation that provided the greatest funding for the institution, that sought to make the institution independent. That one African nation became the victim of United States NATO onslaught, right? That carried out a regime change operation in Libya and removing Gaddafi from power. He was the one. In fact, I was following on Twitter at one point. There was this one professor a white professor from a historically black university. When Gaddafi was under attack, she tweeted, you know, Pan-Africanism is dead. And she wasn't tweeting in a sorrowful way, but it was in a gleeful way, because she knew and understand that Libya represented the leading edge of the independence of the African Union, served as a model for what other African nations should do in terms of supporting the budget of the African Union, in terms of calling for immediate and complete concretization of the Union of the Continent, right? If you recall, there's throughout the 1990s or the 2000s, there was this before in transitioning from the Organization of African Unity to African Union, there's these debates about how the process should unfold. And then you had your conservative forces, right, represented by figures like Thabo Mbeki and Yoweri Museveni, was calling for a slow regional integration, you know, the Southern African Development Community first. Let's get that in place. The Economic Community of West African States, the East African Community, get that in place first. And then you had Gaddafi arguing for, let's do it now. Let's unify the continent now. And he was willing to put his money where his mouth was. So we see a situation where the European powers, the West, the United States, be the funders, the primary funders of the institution, and then the one African funder that was laying down a model for the rest of the African states, they removed them from power. They assassinated them, right? And they did it gleefully and openly. At the time, Hillary Clinton, Secretary of State, in an interview with 60 Minutes or with CBS, she said of Gaddafi, and laughing, you know, channeling Julius Caesar, saying that I came and he died. And then she laughs, right? So that gives you a window into the nature of the African Union and the weakness of it. And not only because it's being led by agents of colonialism, but the empire removed and overthrew, assassinated, and just eviscerated that one force that was giving it any semblance of self-sufficiency and independence. And now it is totally neutered. And they put up clowns, I guess that's the best way I can see it, are caricatures, like Paul Kagame, who headed up the African Union a couple of years ago as a so-called model for Pan-Africanism. It's insane. He's the primary agent of, military agent of neocolonialism on the African continent, whether it's in the Congo or of late, working with the French in Mozambique. You know, he's an African for hire. He's been hired by British Prime Minister. In fact, the former British Prime Minister served as a close advisor to him, Tony Blair. Bill Clinton is his buddy. So you have the capture, let's say. The African Union has been captured by agents of neocolonialism. It's been captured by proxies of the Western Europe, and it's been captured by the West, period, because it doesn't fund itself, it doesn't support itself. And the one source of that independent funding has been vanquished. So you cannot look to the African Union for any kind of salvation whatsoever, or any kind. It's just not a place to go. You have to go to the people on the ground in the respective countries that are waging an indefatigable struggle in the spirit of our independence here, is to try and bring about a unified Africa and a free and liberated Africa.
Okay, to our listening audience, this is the voice of MPH Radio. We're discussing the theme today, Africa, today and tomorrow. What we're going to do right now, we're going to take a few questions from some of our listening audience with our panelists. So we're going to open up our mic. If you have an interest or make a comment or have a question, please call in at 818-337-0016. Hit 1. Please hit 1 and we'll acknowledge your last four numbers. What I'm going to do right now, my co-host been waiting very patiently the whole day through this program. I'm quite sure he has a question or a comment, something that he would like to address as relates to today's theme. We'll bring in Brother Alex. We will give the mic over to you.
Well, thank you, Mr. Lee, first of all. And thank you, our distinguished panel of guests. You have honored me today with information and knowledge. And this knowledge, gentlemen, I'm so glad you're passing it on. Because, yes, in this country today, they are trying to find ways to silence forces like yours, to stop people from telling the truth, to know the knowledge of where they came from, their historical record, their background of information. Once you can take the pride away from a person, their self-esteem, you usually can break them. That was a thing that was done as the slaves came over from Africa. And I hear now that they want to put in the history books immigration, that they weren't enslaved, but they came over as immigrants to this nation. I never want to read a book that ever says any African came here as an immigrant when they were bound in chains in a belly of ships, and so many died just getting here. And upon their backs, that I know that my pride goes forward. So I want to thank you, gentlemen, today for being here. It has been an honor. And one thing I want to ask you, and that's all for you, how do you feel about, because I'm asked this question a lot, when I go out and talk to people and speak to people, the first thing they say is, the people in Africa, I don't know nothing about them. Why should I care? And I want you to answer me on that.
And what we're going to do, we'll get each one of y'all a shot to briefly address that question. We'll start with Brother Bamboshi. Your response to that question, Bamboshi.
It's good Brother brought that question, because it just reminds me of Malcolm X. You know, on one of his recordings says that when he speaks to the brothers and sisters in the street about Africa, they tell him often, we don't want to hear that Africa stuff. We ain't, you know, we ain't left nothing in Africa. We ain't lost nothing in Africa. We here. And Malcolm says that he used to tell them, you lost your mind in Africa. That's your problem. I think that while it might be harsh, the reality is that we have always struggled. And one of the things we have struggled over is identity. And as you remember, in the early 60s, during the civil rights movement, folks used to be called the N-word, Negro. And Negro is a bastardization of the Spanish word negra, which means black. So in the 1960s, there was a great struggle for folks to change from Negro to saying they were black. Not only were they black, but that black was beautiful. That was a powerful psychological struggle that was waged mostly by the people of the then civil rights movement inside of SNCC, inside of CORE, inside of SCLC. Came the 1980s when we progressed from the struggle of being black to realizing that, you know, black is just a color. There's no black land. There's no black nation. And that revolution was based on land, as Malcolm again said. And from there, we begin to realize that we were Africans. Again, we have to quote Malcolm because Malcolm said that if you take a kitten who's having babies and put them in an oven and he has the babies in this oven, the babies don't become biscuits. And if you take the African, bring them here as slaves, put them on plantation, they don't become Negroes. They don't become black. They're still Africans. We are Africans, period. And so this struggle is one that's constantly being waged and has to be waged by our people today to ensure that we understand clearly what our identity is so that we can understand what our interest is and what we must fight for. So thank you for raising that question, my brother.
Okay, Brother Mafis, your response?
I'm sorry, brother. And just quickly repeat the question.
Brother Alexander, you want to repeat your question? Brother Alex?
Yes, I'm here.
Brother Lee, you can just share with us. Okay, good.
Yeah, okay. Go repeat your question.
Yes, I wanted to know what your response would be as I go out and talk to different people, and they wonder why we are so concerned with being black or being called the African, because we came from Africa, and the response has always been that we don't know anything about those people. So why should we learn anything about them? We're so removed from them in this country that so many of my fellow African Americans that they do not understand the importance of our African heritage. And that's what I want you to relate on.
Yeah, thank you for the question, brother. So much comes to mind when you say that, because in organizing, you face that challenge on a consistent basis. You know, what one of our elder historians shared is noteworthy. Ancestor John Henry Clark said that we may not know that we're Africans, but our enemy knows that we're Africans. And that's part of the challenge of the organizing that we have is that letting Africans know that they're Africans and embracing the African heritage. And brother, that's not something that it just takes place outside of the continent, but that's a process that's on the way on the continent as well. You know, in Lumumba, for example, in his early upbringing and before he got 1958 and got to the All African People's Conference in Accra, Lumumba came from a class in the Congo that was wholly manufactured by the Belgians. It's called the Evolue. And that's where they would take Congolese and educate them to really become Belgians, right? Or a copy of a European. So that the nature of white supremacy is that it's global in scope. And so that process where the African has been educated away from himself, educated away from herself, is not only a historical one where, you know, we've been away from the continent for hundreds of years because of the enslavement process, but it's also a contemporary one, which is a product of colonialism that took the best of the African to try and educate them to aspire to everything European. So the response to folks who bring that up is one of education, you know, to walk people to our history and share with them how it is that we arrived at this, you know, condition that we're in today, as Bamboshi laid out the examples that Malcolm used as teaching tools. But the key example from Malcolm is that he was educating the masses, and that's what we have to do. We have to educate through whatever tools that we have at our disposal about how it is that we are still African, whether we recently arrived or we arrived hundreds of years ago. We are Africans. There are really basically two types of Africans. There's Africans that are at home and Africans that are abroad. We're the Africans that are abroad. And Africa is our base, our homeland. So whether we're at home or whether we're abroad, we're Africans and we're fighting for benefit of Africans. So it's just a question, it's an education process that we have to incessantly do, whether in an organized fashion or in our daily movements, constantly reinforce how it is that we're connected to the African continent through ancestry, through heritage, through contemporary relations and networks. That's the duty and responsibility of an organizer to continue to do that, to educate people about our brothers and sisters, our family members, our loved ones, about the how it is that we're still very much African, irrespective of what others would like to say and how we've been educated away from our Africanness, let's say. So that would be the response that I would share, brother.
Thank you, my brother. And Kamal, your response to the question. Brother Kamal.
Yes. First of all, and lastly, we'd like to thank you, Dee, for bringing in this topic on your program to the Africans and the people in the diaspora, the course of Africa, to the world. I would like to say that this is one of my pet projects at this time, of coalition of people serving for the liberation of Cuba. And the reason why Cuba is important, because of Africa. You know, Africans struggled in 1898. They struggled for the liberation of Cuba with an integrated army that was led by Antonio Machado, General Antonio Machado, an African. All throughout the struggle to Cuba and liberate Cuba, even after that, the U.S. invasion of Cuba in 1903, Africans were important in the development of Cuba. They formed a party, and during that time, the mafia was running Cuba. The color party was, with the help of U.S. imperialism, were wiped out. It took Fidel Castro, Che Guevara, and the people to struggle to overthrow that vicious dictatorship of Batista. Cuba sent 50,000 soldiers to Africa to help to fight against apartheid, which at that time the U.S. was supporting the government of South Africa to liberate South Africa from apartheid. As a result, apartheid was wiped out. Mandela was freed from prison that he'd been struggling in for 27 years. And Cuba had his revolution that was instrumental and helped by Africans. And Africa's important to us today because in Cuba, because we say 60% of the people are African or of African descent. And we struggle to support that particular country because of the U.S. vicious sanctions for 61 years. I mean, the overthrow regime assassinate the leaders as it's done in many other countries. But this is why we stand up for Cuba and for the Africans in Cuba. If anybody that's gone to Cuba and visited Cuba, they will speak for themselves. Why? And Cuba is just one country where Africans are that are struggling for liberation. Wherever we are on this planet, our struggle is the same. Africans liberate themselves. First, they must know who they are. You know, that's one of the problems. But then it's Africans, some, I would say all, are struggling to understand what their struggle is and who they're fighting against and why they're Africans and why we should be organized wherever we are. So wherever I go on this planet, and I'm lucky and healthy to go, I'm looking for Africans. Where are they? I go to the continent. Of course, I'm there with Africa. And I plan to do that again. The importance of Africa are important to us wherever we are. Africans are struggling to liberate themselves, whether it be in Cuba, whether it be in Haiti, whether it be in El Salvador, Venezuela, et cetera, et cetera. Africans are struggling to liberate themselves from imperialism, colonialism, and racism. So as I said before at the beginning of the program, we must be united and organized wherever we are. And again, I thank Brother Lee for having this program. And I hope that, you know, he will have programs like this in the future.
Panelists, we're going to take one more question before we do our closing here. Ask for your final thoughts. We have one more caller, been waiting patiently. We can go with caller 6057. Your question or comment, caller 6057.
Certainly. Thank you for having me. Real quickly, in the documentary you shared with us earlier, it was mentioned that that Africa's failure to industrialize on a large scale has contributed to the poverty that it is presently experiencing. The question I have to all three panelists that you have today is the failure to achieve Pan-Africanism, and that is the total liberation and unification of Africa under scientific socialism, does that contribute to its failure to industrialize on a large scale? Because currently Africa is divided into 54 non-politically viable states, right now the way Africa's fragmented, they can't even defend themselves if they were under attack. Libya is one example of that. How is it important that Pan-Africanism be achieved in order for Africa to be able to, to sustain itself?
Please start, Brother Bamboshi, your response.
Great question, Brother Anthony. Great question. I think that if you look at Africa, you'll see that there have been attempts to industrialize Africa, and that all of those attempts have been met with resistance, with assassinations, with regime change. I think if you look, for example, on Kwame Nkrumah, who attempted to build a dam which would produce enough electricity to serve 4 or 5 different countries in that area of Ghana in West Africa, you will see why he was one of the reasons he was overthrown. In Guinea, they have a similar issue that there's water coming off of the Futajala Mountains that could also create enough electricity for several countries in the region there. I think you see that all over the place. Today, in Ethiopia, they're attempting to build a dam that could provide electricity not just to Ethiopia, but probably also to Somalia, to Sudan, to Egypt, to even the little ex-French colony of Djibouti. So, and here again, you see this great opposition to this dam, and you see the opposition taking place against Ethiopia and Eritrea. And you see the U.S. creating sanctions on those countries. Part of the reason for those sanctions are the attempt to build this dam, which would produce electricity, which, of course, would help industrialization in both of those countries and more. So there's always been an attempt to crush any move in Africa to industrialize. They want to keep us at the level of creating little local community creating cultural attires, little statues, little art, that kind of stuff. And also, they want to ensure that their extractiveness, the mineral resources, et cetera, that they take out of the continent continues to flow to the West. So there is that problem of industrialization, and the brother's correct, we do need industrialization. And the only way we will get the industrialization we need is if the trading partners of Africa become Africans, if Africa trade with itself, and also if this extractiveness, this tiffage, the theft of Africa's raw resources, is eliminated, and those resources are used to develop and produce manufactured goods and equipment and services inside the continent first, and then to other countries, other continents. So there's definitely a need, definitely, and pretty hard to accomplish without Pan-Africanism.
Thank you, Bambushi. We'll move next to Brother Maurice.
Yes, but I'll just co-sign anything that Bambushi just shared. I don't have much to add beyond what he shared. I think he made the critical point that it's vital for us to understand that those who sought to industrialize the continent, who sought to develop the continent, who sought to make the continent self-sufficient through their individual nations, and with the expectation of expanding it continent-wide, were eliminated. He brought up the case of the overthrow of Nkrumah. We see the potential, and the enemies of Africans see the potential in having, at the how quickly the continent can be developed and that industrialization can take place, that agricultural development can take place, that food security can take place. We just have to take the case of Burkina Faso under Thomas Sankara for a 3 or 4 year period to see the level of development that that he led threatened the interests of French, of France-Afrique, French West Africa, to the point where they had to enlist one of their stooges in Blaise Compaoré to assassinate and get rid of Sankara. So there is no lack of examples of what can be done in terms of models for the development of the continent as a whole. The challenge for us has always been, or has been, I should say always been, but has been, to be able to protect that development and protect those leaders. Because the moment that the neocolonialists, that the imperialists spot you and see that you're looking not only to advance, but to develop your own people, make them self-sufficient, food secure, but to export that to the rest of the African continent, you come in the crosshairs of the imperialists. They'll either do it, try and eliminate you outrightly using their own military force, as was the case with Gaddafi, or they may enlist one of their stooges, as in the case with Blaise Compaoré, who would be remiss if we didn't mention that he was tried, Blaise Compaoré, that is, in absentia this past week in Burkina Faso for the assassination of Thomas Sankara, and was found guilty and is a wanted man. So there is some modicum of justice that's been meted out by the people of Burkina Faso. So that would be the response, in that we, the models are there. The biggest challenge that we face is that question that both Mamboshi and Brother Kamal raised in terms of sovereignty, the ability to protect the revolution. And it's rare that you're able to do that. We see that in the case of Cuba. And that's why our brothers and sisters here fight so ardently to run interference in the empire, because they're keenly aware that the empire will seek to destroy the revolution and erase any model on the planet to be self-sufficient and to be able to deliver to the people for their own people without the assistance of the imperial forces. So that's the big challenge. I don't know to what extent and how much the Africans who are following that path today can draw on the Cuban experience, but that is one model, probably the sole model that we're aware of in contemporary time that has withstood the onslaught of the imperialists to disrupt the revolutionary process in there. So it's not just a question of industrialization, to sum it up, but it's also the ability to protect and defend the development that you're leading as a nation, whether it's in the area of health, education, literacy, industrialization, you name it. You have to be able to defend it, otherwise it won't see the day of light.
And Brother Kumar, your response.
I didn't get to get all of it clearly. It could be repeated.
He raised the issue of the importance of industrialization for Africa. The Western for years have been able to deny or slow down or make it difficult for Africa to be industrialized. He talked about the importance of industrialization. Just your response to that.
It's very important that Africa be industrialized, but not exploited as a process. You know, China has done some work in Africa, which, you know, there are forces that question it, but we know and we must understand what they did, build railroads, et cetera, throughout Africa, which the opposition is always the imperialism questioning what they do because they weren't asked to do it. So industrialization in Africa, you know, is very important for our people to eat, feel, and travel throughout the continent under a process of a principal agent that is helping them. An African can teach and develop and build themselves. And they build this country, you know, they can build Africa if they're allowed to do it. You know, where Africans are making progress, they're always an enemy around the corner, attempting to exploit it, tear it down, put opposition forces against each other for the sake of exploiting and making a dollar. So that we must be aware of that. But yes, industrialization is very important for Africa. Environmental growth is very important for Africa. Africa is a beautiful continent, and they know it. And we should know it, just how important it is. And that's why we should struggle to organize and build it.
Thank you, Kamal, to our listening audience. This is MPH Radio. You have been listening to organizers and representatives of organizations within your communities that have been doing work for years on the ground in Africa and throughout the world. We have with us Brother Bamboshi Shanga and Kamal Benjamin, representatives of the All African Peoples Revolutionary Party GC. And we have with us Brother Maurice Connie. He's a representative and organizer for Friends of the Congo. We're going to give each one of y'all 1 minute to make our final goodbye and thoughts for the day. And how can we find out and reach or those who may want to support your organization, Brother Bamboshi?
Yes. Thank you. we'd like to say that you can reach out to the AAPRP online at a-aaprp-gc.org. And you will find our website is very informative. Please visit it. I'd like the Brother Africa for having us on his show today. I'd like to say that it is a honor, a privilege, and a pleasure to be on the same show with Brother Maurice Carney and Brother Kamau Benjamin, both of them who are longtime strugglers for our people and in the interests of Africa and African unity. We also would like to encourage your audience to consider the necessity of this struggle that we're in and begin to take whatever steps is necessary to participate fully in this struggle, because this struggle is in your interest and only you can really wage the struggle. Again, my brother, thank you very much.
And we thank you, Brother Bamboshi Shango. Brother Maurice, your final thoughts.
Thank you. Thank you, Brother Lee, for inviting Friends of the Congo to be a part of this this grounding with our brothers Kamau and Bamboshi. I send them all the best. And good health and longevity. It's been a minute since I've seen them both, and just an honor and a pleasure to be on with our brothers in the struggle. And I would co-sign everything that Bamboshi shared in terms of being a part of the struggle. Kwame Ture, almost always, and anything, anywhere, any goes, anything he says is organize, organize, organize. So we encourage folks listening to organize, organize, organize. Join an organization. If you're not able to join an organization, support an organization that's fighting for the freedom and liberation of our people. And that would be my message. And should they wish to be a part of the efforts of Friends of the Congo, they can visit us online at friendsofthecongo.org. For the old school folks, they can reach us in the office at 202-584-6512. That's 202-584-6512 to be a part of the organizing effort that's being led by Friends of the Congo. Thank you. Thank you again, brother. Thank you. Thank Brother Bamboshi. Thank Brother Kamau. Really a pleasure being on with everyone.
It was a pleasure having you, my brother. We thank you for your contribution to today's program. And we now go to Brother Kamau. Brother Kamau, your final thoughts for today. Brother Kamau.
Yo. As I said, I thank you, and it's a pleasure and honor to be on this program with that you have presented, Brother Lee, with Brother Bamboshi. You know, we've been struggling for a long time, and in there, and Brother Maurice. You know, we have known each other for a while, and we have attended each other's programs, and we work together. And I hope we have the opportunity to work together in the future. You know, with the APRPGC and also with the BC Metro Coalition in solidarity with the Cuban Revolution. So any support that you can give us, we thank you for it, and we appreciate your struggle with Friends of the Congo. And it has been a long, fruitful, and hard struggle. But I know you're up to the challenge, and we support you, my brother. We say, Lee, again, thank you. And thank your audience.
And we thank you as well, Brother Kamau. and your organization. All right, listen, audience, this is MPH Radio. We're going to go to a station break with music with a message, and when we come back, we're going to be closing out with a special message to the community from Brother Alex, and we have a couple of announcements we'd like to make. This is MPH Radio. I want to say they don't care about us. If they don't care about you, but do you care about you? That's the question. We welcome you back to UMPH Radio. We're in our final mode of closing out for today's program. But we'll be remiss that was one particular participant we overlooked. We would like to see if this caller would like to just make a brief statement or comment on this program. And we're going to go to caller. Your last four numbers are 4298. 4298 is a statement or comment you'd like to make. We apologize for overlooking you. 4298.
Thank you. I've just enjoyed the analysis and the wisdom of the brothers who've been in the struggle for Pan-Africanism. I came out of the African Liberation Support Committee era, and so it's a little different from being solely committed to Pan-Africanism, as at least the understanding that I have about AARP GC. I just enjoyed and was learning. I'm always trying to learn, and I encourage people to stay the course and to organize. Thank you.
Thank you, Paul. And always, we'd like to thank you for being a staunch supporter of MPH Radio. At this point in time, you can go to our facilitator and member of MPH Radio, Brother Alex Joyner. He has a special message to the community. And right now, we're going to turn this mic over to Brother Alex. Brother Alex, what is your special message to the community?
All right. Thank you, Mr. Lee. And I want to thank Susie for, again, giving us the information. And as we move forward, from the gentleman expressing all that passion and that knowledge, it has really uplifted me today. April's a special month because, it's my birthday month. So, I'm really on a high because also my Super Bowl month of my favorite sport. So I like to move on to a few things because I visited Augusta, Georgia less than a month ago. And I gave a tribute to a black golfing legend. I got a call requesting that I read, "There's a Right Way to Swing." On the show today, from a family member who would be listening in, my speech was an acknowledgement about a pioneer in sports that fought openly for the right to play the game he loved and changed the history of the people of color on the golf course from caddy. I have listened to the news media, and they all are hyped over Tiger Woods coming back from surely a career-ending accident, and is now well enough to play this weekend at the Masters. They say that Tiger has saved golf from extinction. He commands the largest galleries and gets the loudest outbursts after every swing. His fist pump is known and copied all over the world today. But before Tiger Woods was born, there were many others who were not allowed to compete. Today, as the Masters is played for the 86th time, I would like to give you a tribute of how I felt about a man named Robert Lee Elder and my favorite sports game, golf. Watching him as a young child until he finally retired, I gave Mr. Elder the utmost of respect and profession that he endured the harshest of racism and hate. Somebody had to be the first. Mr. Elder played with the best and proved not only did he belong, but he could beat them at their game. They has to be the first to open the door to opportunity, fame, fortune, and respect in any sport. Golf is a game that the individual is almost totally alone in his decisions to compete and endure. A champion is born through hard work, determination, focus on the task at hand, and respect. T97, I watched Eldridge, Taunt, Tiger Woods stand in the small drifting wind at the 18th hole of the Augusta National Tournament on his final putt. He was being cheered overwhelmingly by Mr. Elder from the gallery. After Tiger's shot rolled in, they later embraced in a memorable hug that will last me forever. Mr. Elder said, "This is a happy and glorious day for all Black, for all of us, in all walks of life. I still believe that the Masters in April 1975, with the wind at his back, standing at 8-man corner, 40-year-old Robert Lee changed the golf world forever. Many questioned whether we could compete. Many questioned if we could win. Lee Elder answered them mightily with dignity and professionalism. There's a right way to swing. The best job I ever had when I was a teenager, I worked for the Neighborhood Youth Corps program, which provided jobs for African-American teenagers to learn skills from the different jobs they would be introduced to. The program provided youth with work experience and supported service to improve their future. This program was from the Economic Opportunity Act of 1964 as part of the War on Poverty agenda by President Lyndon Baines Johnson. The basics of the law was derived from discussions between Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and John F. Kennedy. Had this act never become a law, I would never have had the summer job of maintaining golf courses. I fell in love with the sport of golf that summer, along with the tranquil scenes of nature at its best. The greens were more beautiful than any baseball or football field I'd ever seen. The courses had everything. There were long fairways with overlapping trees, sand bunkers with glistening in the sun, majestic waterfalls that flowed into ponds filled with fish and ducks that were floating on top of the water. It was as if heaven had rested on earth. I would watch the men hit the small white golf ball. In my backyard, my brothers had dug holes to put small cans so that we could play the game of golf. At every course I worked on, there was a sign that said, "Members only. No colors or blacks allowed." In my mind, I thought that all men should enjoy this sport. I remember hearing them laugh and talk as they walked from hole to hole. They always got quiet once they approached the hole to knock the ball in. I would stop my hedge clipping, stand there. The men were neatly dressed. They were not out of breath or sweating profusely like baseball, basketball, or football players. These men playing golf seemed to be cool, calm, and collected. One of them gently tapped the ball, and I watched it roll straight to the cup and fall in. This was the game for me. I couldn't wait to tell my dad what I saw. That Sunday after church, my father, who loved all sports, turned on the television to watch a golfing tournament. He said there was something he wanted to see. It was the first time watching a PGA tournament event. I watched the players as they teed off one after the other until an African-American man of only 5'8" tall came out and waved to the crowd. I had never seen a person of color swing at a golf ball professionally. I thought I was dreaming. The announcer said his name was Lee Elder from Dallas, Texas. I watched this man swing his club way back further over his shoulder than any other and slice the air with a tremendous force. I saw the ball rocket off the tee and fly high into the air and the golf ball of his competitors and land in the middle of the fairway. The announcer said in a low hushed voice, "What a swing by the man from Texas. He will be a great one to be talked about in the future." Little did the announcer know how right he was. Robert Lee Elder was born July 14, 1934, in Dallas, Texas. He was the youngest of 10 siblings. Both of his parents died before he was 7 years old. His father, Charles, died in World War II, and his mother, Mink, died shortly after from heartbreak and a shock of losing him. Young Robert lived with his family members in Wichita Falls, Texas, then moved to California. He began to caddy with an older brother who worked at quite a few different golf courses. Then at 16, he wound up at the Tensions Club in Dallas, Texas, where he met a young, poor, aspiring golfer named Lee Trevino. At the Municipal Conference, Edward Harwick allowed the young Robert to practice, and happiness was born to a kid that loved to swing a golf course. In 1961, Elder joined the United Golfing Association with the American Tour that paralleled the main U.S. PGA Tour. He won 4 Negro National Open Championships and came in first in almost all the tournaments he entered in 1966. At age 34, he joined the U.S. PGA Tour, and many began to call him Lee Elder. He was an immediate success. In Arizona in 1968, he was running up to Jack Nicklaus at the Firestone Open, losing on the fifth hole in sudden death playoff, watched by millions. When in the 1971 Nigerian Open, he became the first black golfer to play in the South African PGA Championship. After winning the 1974 Monsanto Open, he received his first invitation to the Masters with the Amen Corner and the Magnificent Magnolias. This was not to be his last. He played the Masters 5 more times. Lee Elder won more PGA competitions and was picked for the U.S. Ryder Cup team in 1979, another first for a black golfer. He won the Jamaican Open 1984 and moved on to the U.S. Seniors Tour. He would win 8 more tournaments before retiring. Robert Lee Elder received the United States Golfing Association's highest honor, the Bob Jones Award, in recognition of his distinguished sportsmanship in golf. At the 2021 Masters, he was one of the ceremonial openers at the first tee, alongside Jack Nicklaus and Gary Player. During his time on the tour, Lee Elder received lots of hate mail and death threats because he played a sport that many thought he had no business in. He endured hotels and clubs that didn't want to accommodate him because of his color. Elder knew his talent would speak for him, and he used his gift well. All the while, he gave to many African-American organizations and charities. He gave to the United Negro College Fund and to Payne College in Augusta, Georgia, where he was awarded an honorary doctorate degree for lifetime achievement for his extraordinary contributions to humanity. Robert Lee Elder demonstrated to the world how the power of faith, hard work, raw talent, guts of the lives, changing their perception of a person of color. Robert Lee Elder was the best of the best. When speaking to the reporters at his first master tournament, who held his historic years as the first African-American to play the course, he was quoted saying, "I don't want to go down in history just for this. I want to be remembered. If I'm to be remembered at all, it's because I was a good golfer." What a humbling remark from a great athlete. I'll always remember his warm smile, knowledge of the game, the fashionable dress that he wore, on and off the golf course, and his awesome swings down the fairways. He was a history maker and gave back to his community. This past week, I grabbed my old master's club out of my bag from my boyhood days and stood on the greens of my local club. I hit the little white ball as hard as I could. It sailed high and far over the trees, 2 bunkers and a par. Or was I just dreaming? The years have passed, and I still enjoy the game. It was me out there on God's green with Lee Elder and Calvin Peet, and I was leading by 7 strokes. What a dream. Please, no one wake me up. I'm on the final 18th hole, tapping a 12-foot putt, and I see the ball rolling straight to the cup. I hear the overwhelming roar from the gallery crowd. After one mighty fist pump is over, that's what's the right way to swing. Thank you, Robert Lee Elder, for being the first to break a barrier that existed for years. Now I enjoy the game I love so much on any public.
Thank you, Alex, for your message to the community. And we would like to make a couple of announcements as relates to what's going on in our community. We would like to remind everyone who would like to receive more information on the recent decision case concerning Thomas and Carla, please go visit the website www.a-aprp-gc.org. Also, to all African people up here in D.C., we'll be hosting an upcoming African Liberation Day, Palestine Day. This year's theme will read as follows. It will read, Unleashing an Offensive of 64 Years of African Liberation Day, Intensified the Revolutionary Struggle Against Capitalism and Imperialism, Zionism and Neocolonialism, Forward to Pan-Africanism, One Unified Socialist Africa. Again, you can find out more information and updates when you visit our site. And for those who are not aware, MPH Radio is partnering up with the African Awareness Association and other groups as they will take a freedom ride tour to Cuba. Everybody who is interested in going, come and join us. If you are interested, please, you can email us at mphradio@yahoo.com or email the African Awareness Association 2@gmail.com. Those who come in under the banner of MPH Radio, we're doing this in honor and remembrance of one of our co-founders and dear brother Emmanuel Joyner. So please, that tour will take place from July 23rd to the 31st. So if you're interested in going, please let's get on board. And like always, because of the pandemic, we are still not holding any physical activities at this point in time without further notice. But we will be here every other week during this program, starting at 1 p.m. So we thank all of you for your past and present support. And if you would like to become a member and join our MPH fan club, please email us at mphradio@yahoo.com. mphradio@yahoo.com. So until next time, we'd like to thank you again for your support. And we want to remind you that don't agonize, just organize. And the best way you can do that, continue to fill in our missing pages of history. We see you 2 weeks from now.
gonna save the nation. We're no support for education. Cause right now it don't make sense. Right now it don't make sense. Let's talk about our part. My heart touch your heart. Let's talk about living. Had enough of dying. That's what we all about. Let's do more giving. Do more forgiving. Yeah. Our souls were brought together so that we could love each other. Sisters, we are here. We are here for all of us. We are here for all of us. That's why we are here. Why we are here. We are here. We are here for all of us. We are here for all of us. That's why we are here. Why we are here.
While we are here, while we are here.